Welcome to iDeveloper Live, episode 22, I think. And with me today, we have no video today of anyone but me. You just get glorious me on the video because I haven't set up a Skype-asaurus yet. Skype won't do conference, video conferencing with multiple people on there. And that's what we have today because we have the one and the only Mr. John Fox.
Hello, Scotty. Hello, world. How are you?
I am very well. And how are you?
Just dandy dandy. I'm once again in my bathrobe, but I'm out of the cubbyhole and into the dining room area because my wife and child are off in Italy right now. So I'm a bachelor for the next several weeks.
So am I right in saying here that when your wife and child are at home, they keep you in the cupboard?
Precisely.
and they will let you out to play when they've gone away, and they'll put you back in when they come home again.
Something like that. It's a big step up from the crawl space underneath the mobile home. But
there we are. That's it. Now, also with me today, or us today, whichever one it is today, the one, the only, Mr. Graham Lee.
Hello, Scotty. Hello, John Boy. Hello, world.
Okay, that's either John's heart is beating very, very fast with excitement you being on, or he was giving you a round of applause.
I was giving you a round of applause.
I thought it was this adrenaline.
Let's get straight on down with the news that came out I don't know how many hours ago, not very many hours ago, that Apple have released, put a press release out telling us what they're going to put in the WWDC keynote. Have we ever heard of this ever before?
The only time I remember them doing it before was actually like 1996 or 7 when they announced the next thing, and they said that they were going to, you know, have Steve Jobs involved with the keynote, and they were going to talk about next step and, you know, what it meant for the Mac. But since then, I don't think they have.
That sounds about right.
Misremembering that.
No, I think you're spot on.
So, okay, one of you, Graham, tell us what was in this press release.
Well, not that much, as it happens. Apple.
Let's not bother talking about it then. Let's move on.
Well, yeah. Let's try to string it out as long as we can. We've got to get 45 minutes out of this, haven't we? So, Apple said that it will unveil its next generation software, Lion, iOS 5, which I think, you know, they hadn't explicitly said before would be announced at WWDC, so now we know that that's coming. And also iCloud registered trademark, Apple's upcoming cloud services offering. Now, what that means is anybody's guess. John?
I think what it is a vindication of what I predicted last show, that they will be offering a comprehensive suite of useful services for app developers, including unlimited storage that you can guarantee every Apple user has because they're giving it away for free, plus a real-time data transfer mechanism that's peer-to-peer. I think it's fantastic. You heard it here first.
You really think that's what it's going to be?
No, I don't think that. I mean, I'm sure it will be some. It will probably be something along those lines, but I wouldn't be so. I wouldn't dare to dream so much, though.
I liked Mark Dalrymple's tweet from about 25 minutes ago, where he said, "iCloud syncing, but Apple keeps 30% of the data."
That's hilarious.
which, if it's based anything on like Mobile Me, isn't far off the truth at all.
Well, I think it would be more like 30% extra data for free.
I mean, you know, if it is an updated version of Mobile Me, which was an updated version of .Mac, which was an updated version of iTools, then, you know, it kind of seems like, you know, Apple really just can't decide what online services are and how they want to market them and, you know, what should be in them. But this is all pure speculation now. I suppose we better wait until, you know, Steve announces something. Oh, of course, that's the other thing that was in the keynote, is that, you know, Sick Leave Steve will actually be presenting it himself.
With a team, didn't it say that?
Yes, yeah. Yes, it does.
It's I think it's interesting as well that it makes a point here. Apple will unveil its next generation software. Do you think this is partly just about making sure people are aware there is no hardware coming in order to stop that disappointed stock slump because there was no hardware coming, even though they said no hardware was coming?
Well, let me ask this question. For near-field communication, do you need special hardware or not?
Yeah, you do. I mean, you need some kind of very local radio. I suppose you could do something over Bluetooth, but that wouldn't be, you know, true near-field communication. Like on the Android side, which theoretically already has it, it's only Google's handset, the Nexus S, that actually supports NFC, and none of the other Android handsets, yay fragmentation, can actually do process NFC.
Well, there goes that idea. Because I was thinking that, you know, why do they do this? Well, they have a lot more competition these days, and markets that have been that Apple's traditionally dominated pretty well, like music. You know, they face the Amazon offering, the Google offering, and I think a Spectre, you know, offers something useful in the chat, saying that maybe it was a way of pressuring whatever, you know, music company stragglers are out there. So they have that, and then I think they're probably feeling the pressure from Android, you know, feeling that they have to kind of say, yes, we are going to have something new. So I don't know.
Well, I was reading somewhere the other day that someone was, I can't remember if they said they knew or whether they were speculating that, because obviously there's Google Music and Amazon Music and everything else as well, that, that Apple have managed to bring on board a whole bunch of music companies for this cloud sharing stuff that the others hadn't been able to do yet, and that was what was going to make Apple just soar back again. I mean, this is the trouble, isn't it, with this term, the cloud? It's a bit fluffy.
nebulous is the word you're looking
yes.
for.
So, yeah, that's the one. Because it's like we're breaking down from identifying almost, you know, this idea of having a device, even a specific device, or even a specific application, and you know, this cloud is just becoming this thing which is just, you know, out there and does everything. And so, when we talk about this iCloud stuff, we could be talking about music, we could be talking about data syncing coming from iOS 5, we could be talking about, you know, email that really works or calendar sharing that really works for a change. It is just becoming very. The world is going through one of its very generic phases again.
I mean, something that I've been talking about with a few developers, including Pilkey, actually, on Twitter, is the idea that, you know, while it's possible to kind of sync data between like Macs and iPhones and web applications and the like, and, you know, obviously John's working on all of that kind of stuff with Memory Miner, so far it's not that easy to kind of synchronize your state between devices. So a key example is like a Twitter client, where, you know, we've all got Twitter on, like, you know, on our phones and on our Macs and on our iPads. But if you read, like, you know, some replies on one of these devices, it doesn't sync with all of the other ones. And that's kind of, you know, the next piece, I think, of the kind of device convergence, if you like, and the synchronization puzzle is actually making it so that if I, you know, stop using my Mac and start using my Apple TV or my iPad, then not only do I get all the same data, but I actually just exactly pick up from where I left off.
So, well, Graham, do you think that this is a technical problem or kind of a I want to say kind of sales problem, meaning that if everybody magically did have some bit of storage, and it doesn't have to be a ton of storage, but I mean to take this particular use case, you know, adding a kind of where am I in reading my tweets across devices, to be able to store that little bit of data, it's not a whole lot, but for developers to use it for you know, widely, they need to know it's there, right? I mean that's kind of a problem I face, where I say, okay, great, I would like to be able to push some data up. Where do I do it? Do I suspect that, you know, hope that they have MobileMe? Do I hope that they have Dropbox? And in both those cases, since it's not a guaranteed part of the user experience, it kind of scares me off as a developer. You know, I plow through ahead, but don't you think that it's not the technology problem, it's that somebody's willing to do it? And I think certainly Google is a lot further ahead, because if you have a Google account, you have quite a bit of infrastructure available for you, and that's just not the case if you're an Apple customer.
No, I think you're right. It's there are technical problems, obviously, kind of something like your position in a stream is just a single number. It's, you know, what is the ID of the latest tweet that I read? But, you know, even avoiding conflicts across, you know, not just, say, two devices, but, like, you know, you might have a phone, an iPad, let's say that you've got Twitter for Apple TV somehow, a desktop Mac and a laptop Mac, that's, you know, five machines already, and you're doing effectively distributed version control, even though it's on a small piece of data. So there is a technical problem that, you know, I mean, if you've ever tried to use sync services, and you know, you're talking with the REM objects guys on the last episode, this isn't necessarily a trivial problem to solve. But I think you're right in that availability of this service, not just has the user subscribed, but you know, are the servers online? Do I know that I'm going to get useful data back and so on? Those are the tricky bits that have probably so far, you know, stopped many developers from looking in, you know, into that use case in too much detail.
So then let's ask the audience, does anybody believe that Apple is really going to start getting social or you know, kind of cloud computing, however you want to put it? I mean, because up until now they really haven't. And so we've all had these hopes, as you pointed out. Would you go on record and saying that this is going to be something new, or is it just going to be, you know, it's something that makes Apple happy? It's probably a better way of putting it. I mean, if they just say, okay, this is our music locker offering and that's it, developers have a nice day, or do you think that they're going to say, we really care to enable a new generation of applications that are highly, highly connected, highly social?
Well, we'll just give people a couple of minutes to catch up with that, obviously the live show is a few seconds behind. Just been checking out a bit more on this press release. I was on board and I've just noticed another press release has gone out this afternoon that iWork is now available for the iPhone and the iPod. Apple have scaled down the iWork apps and pages and numbers and whatever you can now run on your phone.
Yeah, I saw that, and I tried updating just before we came online, but the update wasn't available yet. But they have said that it's going to be an upgrade from the iPad application to a universal app, so you don't have to buy it again if you've already got the iPad version.
Oh, there we are. That's that done. Okay, now we can get back to the chat room, because that wasn't really very developer-y. Not that the rest of it is. And what are the chat rooms saying on this? They are saying it's going to be a field day for a whole new generation of patent trolls. That's the only comment we've had so far. There we are. this iCloud stuff, Apple is not really known for screwing stuff up. I mean, Apple is seen as a huge success story. But this whole online thing, I mean, .Mac was seen as okay. MobileMe, to be honest, has been seen as a little bit of a disaster. Can they afford to get it wrong again? I mean, if they screw this one up, are they going to damage themselves, or do you think that they're so successful elsewhere they can keep screwing this up until they eventually get it right?
That's a good question. But it also kind of depends on what they're trying to do, because my complaint about MobileMe in general is that it spread itself a bit thin and ended up doing nothing really well. I mean, as a shared set of data storage out there, I think it was not very good at all. I mean, it was not a whole bunch of space. I think that the number of times where you mount your MobileMe disk or your .Mac disk, whatever, your iTools disk, and it kind of freezes up the finders, it kind of turned me off to it. So they didn't get that right, and then they made a furtive attempt to having, you know, nice web applications for reading your mail and whatnot, and that's been kind of good. But, I mean, it's a kind of a more pleasant execution of a mail client than, say, Gmail. But as a lot of people pointed out, since it doesn't kind of have the searching capabilities or the, you know, fast searching capabilities and unlimited storage space, that people kind of said meh. So I don't know. If the only way that I think that they can be successful at this thing is kind of choose one thing that they want to do, at least to get started, and say, you know, now we're going to do it really, really well. So we'll kill Dropbox, and now every Mac user has something that just works flawlessly. Whether that's what they're going to do, who knows?
It does seem odd to me that I mean, it's kind of about the entire IT industry in general over the last few years, and particularly the giants, so like Google, Microsoft, and Apple, is that they've all just kind of started like competing with each other on things that each of them is individually very good at, which, you know, I mean, just seems like a very easy way to lose a lot of money and reputation. So you've got, you know, Apple moving into what is, you know, usually Google's field with the with this cloud stuff, and, you know, MobileMe was perhaps their first serious attempt at that, and Google trying to move into what Apple are doing with Android and with music and movie stores, and then also trying to compete with Microsoft on like the operating systems and the browsers, and you've got Microsoft trying to compete with Google on the search and with Apple on with Windows Phone, and I just can't understand why they don't go, oh, that company's doing this really well, let's like integrate with that so that people buy our products, rather than competing with it when we've got absolutely no record of success in this area.
Is it because you think all of these companies recognize that actually with improving bandwidth and everything else, providing a life solution out there in the cloud, for want of better words, is the future of where making money is going to be? And, each one of them, it doesn't matter where they are today and whatever else, if they can't get a decent offering there in the next year or two, then actually the future is going to rave for them. Is that why everyone is so keen on trying to just get this right?
Well, so you think it's kind of like a lifestyle computing thing that's, they think one of them is going to be the brand that people go to for their data and for their phones and for their whatever we're using in 10 years' time that isn't called a computer anymore?
Well, I think people have had seen in the past, with the history of the internet as it is now, that people don't talk about search, they talk about Googling. And so is it next about where your data is, where your services that you're being provided are? I mean, it's moving beyond email, so where is your music, where are your videos, where are your chats with your family, where are your photos, and it's and are people looking, they really feel that there's going to be a player that's going to become the Google that will say, where do you, whatever the word's going to be, squidgy squodge.
Excuse me while I go register that domain.
Squidgysquodge.com. You heard it here first. Is this why it's so important to people? Because actually it's got nothing to do with technology in a way. It's got to do with the business people are saying, this is where the big money is going to be, and this is where we've, if we don't get in there, then we're stuffed.
Well, I think Apple created this problem for themselves. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that their big marketing thing was, Digital Hub, right? And so Digital Hub, they were able to dominate without having any dependencies on anywhere else when you were talking about, at best, a local area network, right? And Apple is famous for not wanting to be dependent on anyone. There's lots of talk about when they released the iPhone, would they become their own carrier? So they did the next best thing and kind of cut a good deal with AT&T, it gave them lots of control. Well, they can't really do that. It's not as if they can go to Google or Amazon and say, hi, we would like to be able to take advantage of your much further advanced, cloud computing infrastructure, but we want to have lots of control. If they can't make that deal with the same people who are, as Graham pointed out, competing against them on the fronts that they used to be dominant on. So Apple really has absolutely no choice but to do this stuff, but at the same time, they don't have a good track record of it. I would imagine if there are things that keep Apple executive team up at night, it is this. It is their lack of track record and capability in cloud computing. Because I don't see how you can maintain the Apple user experience in a networked world without getting this stuff right.
Okay, so just trying to bring this, because remember, we're not a general Mac podcast, we're a developer podcast. Let's just assume that Apple are in this game and they're going to stay with this game and they're going to keep trying to get it right because they see the business potential of it. Okay, the iPhone was a very successful device, but it only became a massively successful device when developers started developing for it. And the reason it became massively successful was partly because it was such a great device, but you know, Apple produced some really, really good developer tools and a developer SDK, which made developing for it easy. So is actually, or easier, so is actually, do you think, this, the future of the sort of cloud computing success, you know, where Apple may want to go, to be actually, let's create an environment, and this is why maybe it's coming at WWDC as well, let's create an environment where it's easy to let developers create plugins, applications, applets, whatever the terminology becomes, where people can interact with their life data in interesting ways, and we're going to make that available to developers. Because let's face it, you're writing stuff for the Google platform is a bitch. It's really hard work. It's all sort of stuff. So, you know, is this where they're? Is this where they could win, you think?
Yeah, I think that's you're absolutely right. That's the way it has to go. I mean, you're right that you know Google App Engine, that's got a Java API, isn't that right?
It's Python, actually.
Python, right. Okay. So, you've still got to kind of work with Google's API. And you know, Microsoft have their kind of Azure cloud thing, which has a .NET, kind of C# interface. And so that integrates well with Windows desktop and people who already do Windows desktop programming. If Apple want to make a cloud service that developers can use to enhance, the features and capabilities of their iOS and Mac apps, then it's going to have either an Objective-C interface or just some developer experience that iOS developers can get to grips with very easily. So far the only winner, as far as I can see, in cloud computing is Amazon, and that's they don't have an API at all. They just let you use whatever running on whatever operating system you want, and that suggests that nobody is actually doing this kind of distributed style cloud computing particularly well yet. If no API is better than all of the available APIs.
Well, Paul, I mean, isn't S3 an API? I mean, I know that they when I think of Google, Amazon Web Services, two things. There's EC3 that says, yes, you can put whatever virtual image you want and run whatever operating system you have, so long as you don't mind the instance being yanked out from under you at any moment. Mm. And then there's S3, which it's kind of like WebDAV, but it's a little proprietary thing on top of
yeah.
it. So, and I think that that's an important thing. And I think that Apple could do a lot of different things that would make me happy, but I think make a lot of other developers happy. And this is where these two points come together. So Apple announces iWork, and they've had iLife for the longest time. And a number of developers who want to interact with all this great digital lifestyle data, memory miner certainly included, but not at all exclusive. And now you have them with iWork kind of getting into some type of reasonable office productivity package. So Apple would need to be able to make it possible for people to interact with the data that's being produced by their flagship applications, add their metadata, add their value-added services or whatever on top of it, and move that data around to any Apple device that's out there. And that seems like a fairly attainable set of goals that Apple could do that would make developers happy. Because when you were saying that they needed to extend it to make easy for developers to use, there's kind of two ways I could think about that. One is a direction that they kind of push with a little bit with dashboard, and then kind of it seems to have run out of steam, like saying, hey, if you're a web developer, use your nice CSS and JavaScript skills and make a little nice little tight to fit to purpose application applet that we can put up there, and that will be nice. And then they kind of said, well, if you're a serious application developer, here's a serious set of SDKs and a serious business proposition. You can make money and enjoy doing it and only need one person to do it or a small group of people. Now, it's kind of they've saturated both those points. If you want to make a nice, webby looking thing, you certainly don't need Apple, and Apple doesn't really have any offering like Heroku or other, or Google App Engine for that matter. So they have nothing for the kind of JavaScript web crowd. And they have nothing that makes this very, very hard problem of data syncing and peer-to-peer communication. They have no story there, so that they have nothing to kind of help advanced developers with their challenges. So
what about this? Okay, first of all, yeah, there's the whole thing of iWork.com has been basically untouched since it was released in 2009. Are we going to see a bigger tool set in this iCloud stuff that comes along tomorrow, next week? You know, is part of iWork working and all that sort of stuff? Because that seemed to have been, that's gone very quiet. But just imagine this. What about if iOS 5 had location-aware APIs within all of the Cocoa APIs? So, for example, you could just see the iCloud file system for a user that was logged in. It was a local file store, and therefore your applications could integrate with it. Or, you know, the address book API would automatically just work with the address book you kept in the iCloud all the time, as opposed to having to sort of be something local. In other words, you know, with iOS 5, we see this complete integration that you can write applications that integrate with all this stuff that's in the background, just without even having to care that we're now in a cloud. You are developers, write great applications for these mobile devices. We'll sort out all the crap that goes on in the background.
It would be nirvana. I mean, if Apple were to be able to say, write to this location, that I don't say it's a location, but I think it comes down to the user being able to say, this is data that I really do want out in the cloud, right? So you can say some portion of my iPhoto library, I just want this out there in the cloud because it makes it so much easier for me to share with other people, you know, other Apple users or Facebook users or whatever. And same thing with my music and same thing with my address book and work documents and things like that. If there's something that's built into Lion or Lion Plus, whatever, Cheetah, Giraffe they come up with, that lets a user designate a file as a replicated synced object of some sort, it would be glorious. It would be glorious, glorious, glorious. But it makes me wonder if Apple could afford all this. I mean, because Amazon does Amazon Web Services because they're doing it anyway. They have to do it for their business and they actually use it, and it makes some money for them. Apple is never going to be in the business of providing these kind of generalized cloud services to anybody other than themselves and people who are directly writing for their, you know, for their platform. I mean, what do you think it costs to give, you know, 30, 40, 50 gigabytes of space, probably more, you know, to everybody? I mean, even if you factor out all the stuff that is replicated purchased music, right? So obviously there's savings with that. Just the amount of stuff that I produce, that the average person with photographs and video that really is a unique object, it's a fair amount of space. And then that's a fair amount of network traffic in and out to do it. That's no small undertaking for anybody.
Yeah, it's telling that, you know, both Microsoft and Apple, well, yeah, we're still kind of openly speculating on what iCloud is based on the fact that we were told what its name is. but, you know, they're both supposedly got these cloud products, and both of them use, you know, third-party content delivery network. They both use Akamai,
right,
for distributing their web content. So it suggests that they probably haven't actually got a global IT infrastructure that they can rely on themselves, and that they, you know, their own IT department trusts to deliver their own websites on.
That's true. I forgot about Akamai. Now, who owns Akamai? Are they an independent entity still, or of some sort?
Yeah, I think they're a public company.
Interesting.
Well, it's going to be interesting. Well, by this time next week, we're going to know. We're going to know, and all will be revealed. Well, you two will know, because you two would have been in the keynote. Oh, it's Tuesday, isn't it? I keep thinking it's Monday. Even I will know by this time next week, because it's out there. Okay, we were going to talk about something else. Graham, we invited you on for a reason. But before we talk about that reason, I realise we've not even introduced who you are. I mean, people probably know who you are by now because you've been on so many times before. But before we go into our next little subject, just remind us who you are.
Okay, so, thanks, Scotty. My name's Graham Lee. I run a company in the UK called Fuzzy Aliens that is a security consultancy service for iPhone, iPad, Mac application developers. That's pretty much me, really.
Well, last week on the show, we saw that you'd had WWDC Fuzzy Aliens produced. Are they all packed and ready to go? Are they all in quarantine and going through animal control and everything to get over to San Francisco?
Yeah, I've had them inoculated against hepatitis and C-sharp, and the visual basic jab is coming up next week.
There we are. And so how many of these things are you bringing to San Francisco?
Well, I did have about 250, but I know I've given some away
escaped.
Already. Yeah, indeed. So they've kind of made their way around the UK countryside. There will be some. You know, come up and find me at the conference if you want your own little fuzzy alien. As Simon Wolf said last week, they're worth the $1,500 ticket price on their own.
So
they are.
Graham,
now, it'd be... Because they are so valuable, we need to make sure that we don't let you get off scot-free like we did like other guests. So Graham demands a big hug and a big kiss in return from one of these aliens. Please make sure you show him some love so that he can give you an alien.
Graham, I'll give you a dollar if when you arrive at customs and you have a little box with one of these little fuzzy alien thing and they say, what's in the box? And you say, my hairy little balls, would you like to touch them? Like to have a look.
I thought when you came into the USA, then the Transport Security Administration touched your hairy little balls anyway.
No, not coming in, I don't think. It's only when
you're just a little, if you don't mind.
Yes.
We're going to move on. Graham, why are you here? I don't mean in general. I mean at this show tonight.
Well, I thought it would be a good idea to talk about this Mac Defender and Mac Guard rogue antivirus software that people have been reporting on over the last week.
Right, fill us in with the backstory because maybe not everyone's heard of it.
Okay, so it actually goes back to the beginning of May when one of the antivirus vendors on the Mac platform, a French company called Intego, reported that they were seeing what's called a rogue antivirus application. That's a very common, in fact, probably now the most common form of malicious software on Windows. It doesn't kind of have any tricky technical component to it. It's not like a worm or a virus. It's just an application that looks like an antivirus app and tells you that your computer is infected, but that you've got the unregistered version so it can't clean up the infection. And so if you enter your credit card details, you can pay for the upgrade to the full version that will clean up your computer. Of course, when you put your credit card details in, you're not actually paying for an upgrade to a full antivirus product. You're giving your credit card details to the usually criminal organizations that develop this malicious software. So you see a lot of money go out. You might see them use your information to set up other credit cards in your name or other identity theft activities, but you won't see the problem go away. As I said, this is the most common form of malicious software on Windows. Google say that of all of the malware they find when they're indexing the web, 50% of it is this fake antivirus stuff. This is probably the first time that it's been infecting the Mac, though.
Are you going to finally take credit for writing it?
Of course not.
Okay, so you filled us in with this backstory and whatever. So, so why do we care? Well, other than we don't want to give away our why is we as sort of the people who listen to the show are intelligent people. They're probably looking out for what's going on. They're developers, so why do you think we need to know? What do we need to learn?
Well, the interesting thing about it is it doesn't really represent a change in the risk. As I said, there's not much. There's not much kind of technology in one of these applications. It just relies on tricking users into doing something you don't want. What's interesting in this case is that while there have been occasional reports of new malware being detected, and then everyone claims that they've never heard of anyone who's actually been infected, and then it disappears, Yeah, this one has kind of stayed current for at least a month and has caused Apple to announce that they're going to install a removal tool in the next version of the operating system. And there are estimates that somewhere between 60,000 and 120,000 people have been infected with this. What that means is that it kind of proves in a way that you cannot expect users of your software, whatever that software is, to be interested in the kind of the technical aspects of it, security or whatever else. That our job as software developers is to take care of that stuff for us. So I mean, you could look at this as a failing of the platform or of Apple to stop people getting tricked by these by these malicious software creators. But then does that put some onus on us as independent app developers to be taking care of all of the technical details of software, whether it's the file system interaction, security, and so on, to the point where if a user is already trusting us to have done the right thing, then maybe we should actually be stepping up and doing the right thing.
Scotty, do you do the right thing?
I always do the right thing, John. I'm proud of it. Proud of it. So, I mean, great. I mean, antivirus, this whole thing here about, do we need antivirus software, everything on the Mac? The point is here, this isn't a virus as such. This is malicious, malware or whatever you want to call it. I mean, so anyone who was running antivirus wouldn't have been protected against this anyway, other than they might have said, wait a minute, I've already got antivirus.
Well, some of the antivirus applications would detect this stuff, and I think most of them have been updated now to detect it and stop it from running. Of course, the irony is that people who are going out on the web looking for antivirus software to download might have come across this rather than something real. So something that's often brought up as a I think the police are onto you, Scotty. Shall I let you deal with that?
Yeah, don't worry, I'm running. John, take over.
Okay, cool. So something that people often say is, I don't need to worry about this. I only download software from people I trust. And then you have to ask, well, who do you trust? And who do you choose to trust just on the information that's available on their website? And, why do you trust that? Like, what makes you kind of credulous in those cases? So, going back to what I was saying before, there's a limited amount of information, particularly independent information, that people can use to identify whether software is good or bad fundamentally. Obviously you've got kind of specific cases like the Mac and the iPhone App Store, where presumably if you trust Apple, and you did to some extent when you bought your Mac or your iPad, then you trust the software that they're selling through that store to be something that they want to put their name with. But out on the web, how can you say to the 100 million iOS users, oh, fine, just only download stuff from people you trust, and then not give them any information on who to trust and how to how to evaluate that trust? It seems like it's a very unbalanced situation that actually favors malware creators and not general people on the internet.
Graham, what do you think Apple could possibly do moving forward that they haven't already done to, if anything? I mean they can't go back and do the types of things that they lampooned Windows users for, saying, hey, would you like to do this? Would you like this? Always this thing popping up asking if you're going to do that. It seems unlikely you're going to do that. I mean, whenever there's this type of there's malware on the Mac, it comes along people saying, we told you so. Do you think does this change anything in your opinion? Is there something that about the type of users that are on Mac now? Or,
well, as I said, I don't think that the risk has actually changed that much. It's just that, you know, someone is exploiting this risk that exists, and it's, you know, there's a single event that has become important. Looking for analogies, there was always a risk that an earthquake near Japan could destabilize a nuclear reactor. That risk hasn't changed, but an earthquake has happened, and that did destabilize a nuclear reactor. So what I think, what Apple can do, they reacted to this thing in a rather incomplete way. You know, they said, this is how you remove the malware. And of course, you've got the problem there that this software is always being iterated. You know, just as any good or bad software engineer knows, the value is in providing updates to your users. So if you say, this is how you remove this version, then they'll just come out with another version that, you know, needs to be removed in a different way. Apple have said that they are going to release a removal tool, and that should help people because, you know, as new versions come out, presumably Apple can analyze these new versions and then add the ability to their removal tool to get rid of those as well, which is a situation that Windows users already have with Microsoft's malicious software removal tool. So there definitely are things that Apple can have done, and I think that they're currently in a position where they're, you know, while they've been talking about security for a long time, and you have been improving the security of Mac OS X, and you did a pretty good job with the security model of iOS, their ability to react to incidents on their platform, you know, just hasn't been tested yet. And so they haven't, you know, built up any particular competence at kind of producing timely security updates, at communicating with their users about the problems that exist and the way that they're going to fix it. That's fundamentally what needs to change, because, you know, if you say, well, we can bake this technical countermeasure in that stops this particular attack, then of course malware authors are going to try and find something else to do. It's always going to be a kind of an arms race. So it's actually your ability to respond that's the most important thing, rather than what you're currently doing right now, the current state of your defenses. I mean, if you look at say where Windows 7 is now in comparison with Windows XP a few years back, what Microsoft have done to improve the security of that platform is actually a hell of a lot. And I'd say that Windows 7 and like Mac OS X 10.6 are probably roughly comparable in terms of security posture. It's just the ability to react and to evolve that needs to be improved.
This is the first time Apple themselves have ever had to make some type of public statement about malware that isn't, it's not a problem, right? I mean, if this is the first time they've shipped something, do you think that this is kind of the end of innocence in some ways?
I think it's, it's certainly the first time that they had to go, what we told you a few years ago about, you know, Macs being immune to viruses, that's not true. And so, you know, I don't know, obviously, the details of the internals of this removal tool, how many people they've got working on it, how quickly they're going to update it. But we can look at kind of previous efforts. Mac OS 10.6 introduced a thing which people are calling X-Protect, which detected, you'll remember a Trojan horse called iWork Services that went around BitTorrent claiming to be an update to iWork, or there was a version claiming to be an update to Photoshop as well, possibly Microsoft Office. And then when you installed that, that was actually a Trojan horse, and it did bad things when it was installed. And Apple announced a thing that would, when you downloaded a file that contained iWork Services, it would detect it and it would stop you running it. The problem is they only then kind of updated their set of identities maybe three or four times in the intervening time that Snow Leopard has been out. Whereas Microsoft, with their own Security Essentials tool, are updating it a few times a day. Some of the other dedicated antivirus vendors are updating kind of hourly. You probably don't need to update hourly yet on the Mac, and perhaps you never will. But you certainly need a more timely response than issuing a press release within a month, because a press release ultimately isn't solving the problems that people are actually having on their on their real computers.
And so, back one more question. So, I mean, since not trying to put you in the mind of a malware writer, do you think that there's something different about the Mac user base now that a large number of switchers have come over, who are would respond to such a thing, saying, "Hey, you've got a virus. You need virus antivirus software." If people who've been using the Mac for a long time are kind of saying, "No, I don't, because I've never had one before. This is obviously malware." Versus a Windows user, they see that thing all the time, and they're not familiar with what is the official, antivirus software, since Apple doesn't make one, and there's not, I don't know what brand it would be. So, since in the absence of some knowledge about that, it seems like a credible positive thing. Do you think that's what happened?
So, that's one possibility. Another possibility is just that nobody tried doing this up until now. It's evidently been proven to work on Windows users over the last few years. I think that the first certainly the first kind of reported case of this type of software I can think of goes back to 2006 on Windows. It's not even a particularly old way of targeting Windows users, and there haven't hitherto been a great number of Mac users. I don't think there's any there's any difference in the physiology of the brain of a Mac user and a Windows user, to make their kind of risk aversion or their credulity, any different. Perhaps differences in experience. So people coming over to the Mac from Windows, have heard these stories from other Mac users and from Apple's PR saying that it isn't a problem anymore, and so get surprised when they see this pop up saying that it is a problem and they need to do something about it. But fundamentally, I think it's more people targeting a new sector, if you like, than there is some change in the Mac user base. I mean, you've got to realize that while it's obviously not legitimate businesses who are producing this malware, the market force economics still apply. Every time they convince someone to enter their credit card details, they may be getting a few tens of dollars out of them. Well, if you offer a cross-platform version of your malware, so Mac and PC, then you've got so many extra multiples of tens of dollars. It's effectively a differentiator in the evil marketplace, if you like. That's what I think the reason we've seen this fundamentally comes down to is just people trying something new.
Scotty,
right? For you. Well, that's been I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Oh, good. That's good then. Right. I think we're going to head into a wrap-up now, but we can't do a wrap-up without doing our final WWDC top tip and predictions. Because next week it will be all pointless because it's already gone on. John, do you have any more stunning advice for people visiting WWDC next week, maybe for the first time?
I have two. One is you should definitely come to the photo walk that I've been blamed for organizing at 11 a.m. on Saturday. Come down and meet in front of the rocket. That's a sculpture near the ferry terminal, because it will be a chance to have some tasty food, which is an important part of your San Francisco experience. ample opportunities for nice photography, and we can take a long walk and or a ride on the light rail to a neighborhood called Dogpatch to see the last remnants of industrial wharf San Francisco. That's first bit of advice. The second thing, and
will that walk be over by 7 p.m.?
So yeah, easily.
That's right.
I mean, I don't think it'd be more than, you know, a couple hours. It's very leisurely. It's just basically a way to see bits of San Francisco that you might not otherwise see.
I was just making sure you'd finish by 7 p.m. because you're picking me up from the airport.
That's on Saturday. I thought you were coming in on Friday.
No, I'm coming in on a Saturday.
Oh, well, yes, it will definitely be done by then.
You'd have been at the airport a long time.
Yep. So the second bit of advice, and this is very serious. This is there's an excellent exhibit at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art on Edward Muybridge, who is a photographer who is best known for his time motion studies. And it is stopping on, I believe, on Tuesday. So if you are in San Francisco on Saturday during the day and you're not going to this walk, or on Sunday, I think anybody who's an Apple developer that is interested in photography or animation or time motion, this guy is a pioneering, pioneer artist in this field. I went to see it on Sunday. I loved it, and it's highly recommended.
Brilliant. That's very high quality stuff there from you, John. Thank you very much. Graham.
Well, so I have the problem that I can't actually remember all of the WWDC top tips you've already had on the show. Let me try suggesting that people go on the San Francisco photo walk on the Saturday morning. That's at 11 a.m. No, I'm joking about that one. I would say, though, definitely don't just turn up to the sessions and, you know, and sit through the sessions and then go back to your hotel. You know, go out to the social events, even like, you know, due to coming over from the UK, I'm always jet lagged at these things. So I tend to get up at about 5 a.m. and head over to a coffee shop near the Moscone Center. There's a Starbucks just around the corner on 4th Street that's open pretty much all the time that I've ever tried to get in. And so, you know, I sit in there in the morning having a bit of breakfast and a coffee and, you know, doing some code. But come in, say hello if you're up at 3 o'clock in the morning as well. Talk to other attendees and Apple engineers. You get much more of a chance to meet up with people have outside the conference than relying on meeting, you know, 1 in 6,000 people in the hallways in the conference center.
Very good. And I think I'm going to do food-based as well, because as John said, yummy food is important. So I'm going to give you a tip for either end of the day. John could give far more than this, but I'm going to give you the ones. I suggest breakfast at Dottie's. Great breakfasts, great environment, great atmosphere. You'll have to queue for probably at least 30, maybe 40 minutes, but it's worth it. So do a breakfast at Dottie's. And that night when you want something a bit nicer food-wise, book yourself into Le Mans, South Van Ness, Peruvian restaurant. Been there a couple of times with John. John, is it good or is it good?
It's freaking tasty as all hell.
Yeah, so just don't book it out so that I can't get to go there, because it's one of the few places I guarantee I will go every time I visit San Francisco now. Okay, so that's it. That should be it, and I might see you in one of those two places if we just happen to collide. That could be messy.
One last thing. I would point out that if people are looking for a list of parties, they could do far worse than to go to macindie.com, where there's Dave Spector has put together a nice list of parties and events, including the photo.
There is. That's it, macindie.com. Thank you for that, John. And I also believe there is an iPhone app that is out now. What's it called?
WWC
Parties. That's the one.
I think it's called Parties. Okay. It doesn't have WWDC in the name. I assume Apple because didn't
No, that would have probably been fair. Okay, people are saying good things about iWork, the updated iWork on the iPhone on Twitter, although people are making out the points that it's got some new ways of doing things in, spring-loaded folders and such, which would have probably got any of our apps rejected up until now. Maybe that's a talk for soon. Next week, not sure when the show's going to be, because we're going to be at in San Francisco for WWDC. We will try and get a show in at some point. Just watch the tweets and try and join us online during the show if you can. Otherwise, just watch for it on the feeds. But John, just remind people where they can find you if they're sort of just not able to get to WWDC and they need to make their week almost as good?
The best way to do is then to find me on Twitter as Djembe, D-J-E-M-B-E, like the West African drum, or they can come to memoryminer.com, find out all about Memory Miner, or read my blog on memoryminer.com/blog.
And Graham, for all those people who can't sleep because of the jet lag and they need to read something on security to help, where can they find you?
Everyone in San Francisco is going to come up and touch my hairy little balls and apparently give me a hug as well. Those people who can't should go to Twitter, I Am League, that's I-A-M-L-E-E-G, and there's no form of African instrument that that's based on.
That you're aware of.
I am Scotty, and you'll find me on Twitter as MacDevNet. You can find our video training courses at iDeveloper.tv, and tomorrow morning, but both probably if you're downloading this, it will already be out, our QuickTime QT Kit course will be available. Go and download it. Go pay for it. Go give me money and go be educated. What more could you want to do? So, right, that's it from iDeveloper Live, episode 22. Until next time, you take care.
Dance, Scotty, like the trained monkey you want to be.
We didn't have any Russian brides on this week.
No.
Right, there we are. Thank you very much, everybody.
Hey!